The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox, and you're listening to The Guardian Science Weekly podcast, completely free, just for this week, of swearing.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, what do you get when you start with a studio? Add one mathematician, then add another mathematician. Yes, it equals a special maths podcast.
He said, right, I've done it. But it was 250 pages long, plus 3 gigabytes of very difficult computation.
We use numbers to build a brain.
And this is really a great topic for mathematicians to study.
And to explain evolution.
Orange is better than blue. Blue is better than yellow. But yellow is better than orange.
Plus, we grabbed Brian Cox when he dropped in on the Guardian Science Desk.
The resolving power of eyes, right, is obviously related to the wavelength of visible light. Are there animals that have bumped up against that physical limit, that physical restriction?
That man's gone very showbiz since he was last in our studios.
A well-known supermodel came up and started talking about entropy, said that she'd loved the series and recited back to me what she'd understood about entropy and second law thermodynamics and got it absolutely correct.
And calculate this. Take some cuckoos in an arms race, multiply that by a machine that can replace scientists, and divide by spider-encrusted trees. Work that out and you get this week's news.
This computer program was actually able to discover the law of conservation of energy.
Trees swathed in spider webs, which are killing the trees.
The better the cuckoo is at mimicking a particular bird's egg, the more vigorously that species of bird detects and kicks out cuckoo's eggs.
Hold on to your hats. This is a No Calculators Allowed edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. Before we start, a message for our American listeners. Whenever we say the word maths in this podcast, in your language, that means math. Okay. Well, it's nice to have Nell back in the studio with me. How are you, Nell?
Hello, I'm very well.
How's your maths knowledge?
It's not as good as okay, the people well, look, look,
look, we have two experts in maths I'm going to introduce in just a second. But so I think we need to sort of get your math chops out and understood so that we know, you know, what kind of level we're dealing with here.
Worrying.
So I'm going to give you an equation. It's just a simple y and x equation. I want you to differentiate it y with respect to x in this equation,
dear.
Okay? It's very simple, this. It's very simple. Y equals 2x plus 7x cubed. What is the differential with respect of y with respect to x? Come on.
2 plus 21x?
Okay, you can actually do that really quickly. Fair enough.
Okay.
Now,
I think you missed an x squared there.
X squared.
Exactly.
You said 2x plus 7x cubed.
Yeah. So 7x cubed differentiated is 21x squared.
Yes,
that's right. Anyway, sorry. On to our guests. Our first guest is Richard Elways. And Richard, you've been described as overwhelmingly mad about mathematics. Richard is a teacher and researcher of mathematics and a visiting fellow at the University of Leeds. His previous book was Maths 1001, so the basics of all maths. And his latest one is called How to Build a Brain. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here.
Apparently, you're a whiz on model theory, and your Erdos number is 3. Tell us about your new book.
Okay, my new book is called How to Build a Brain and 34 Other Fascinating Uses of Mathematics. And it really takes a look at some of the exciting bits of maths that you won't have learned at school and you don't need to know too much, or in terms of how to solve equations and so on, to appreciate some of the great ideas.
So the stuff that should be interesting to people who don't have these knowledge in front of them, but might even be a bit afraid of maths, essentially.
Be a bit afraid. Yeah, it's the fun parts of maths, definitely. Yeah.
And Erdos number, quickly tell us what that is.
Okay, so your Erdos number is, it's how closely you are connected to this Hungarian mathematician called Paul Erdos. So Paul Erdos has an Erdos number of 0. Anyone who published a paper jointly with him has an Erdos number of 1. Anyone who published a paper jointly with one of them has an Erdos number of 2. And then you get to me with Erdos number 3.
And he's an icon of mathematics.
He is an absolute icon of mathematics. And certainly someone who was overwhelmingly mad about maths, even possibly to a greater extent than
right,
myself.
Richard, you've definitely met our other numbers specialist in the podcast today. Tell us your little story about
The last time that I met Ian.
Your guest.
So Ian might not remember this, but it was at a conference that he organised, or at least he was involved in organising, and I was a young researcher coming to give one of my first research talks, and I was quite nervous because it was a big crowd of people. And so I stepped up to the platform to give my talk, but what I hadn't realised and what Ian hadn't realised is that the previous speaker had left the auditorium and was still wearing his clip-on microphone. So I started to try and discuss these exciting developments in model theory, which I'd been working on, and there were some extraordinary noises coming from coming through the speakers in the room, which was extremely distracting to everyone, not least of myself.
Well, that Ian Stewart, do you remember this?
It takes me back. Yes, I suddenly have a vivid picture of this. I'd completely forgotten that.
Well, Ian Stewart is a good friend of this podcast. He's emeritus professor of mathematics at the University of Warwick, fellow of the Royal Society, and no stranger to these studios. He's written far too many books for me to mention, but his latest is called The Mathematics of Life, which this is a book which is fascinating. It's not just about the basics of mathematics, it's about how mathematics itself is changing to describe biology. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, the idea is that mathematicians and biologists are finally getting their act together and coming to cooperate on scientific problems. And the result of this is a lot of new mathematics is coming into being because biology needs it. And mathematics that we might not have thought of as terribly useful has started to turn up in biological problems. So the idea of the book is to kind of sketch with a rather broad point of view the amazing variety of mathematics that is now being used in biology, and showing how the biology is feeding back into the mathematics to give things that mathematicians really find interesting in their own right.
Well, before we move on to the advanced stuff, Richard, why don't we start with you, and let's talk a bit about the basics, the stuff that you think people might find interesting but should also know. We should all know how to calculate sums and work out percentages and things, and I'm assuming that most people who listen to this podcast can do that sort of thing. But tell us what you think the canon of mathematics should be for any intellectual or intelligent person.
Well, I mean, I think there are different ways to answer that question. There's the practical stuff that people need, the sort of basic numeracy stuff. But I think people can get really bogged down in that and not see the wood for the trees to some extent, because there's so much exciting maths out there. And for me, I think the world of geometry really contains some fascinating ideas, which the ancient Greeks, for example, were very familiar with. They studied the sort of shapes that one can build in three-dimensional space, and came up with this bewildering variety, really starting with the philosopher Plato, who discovered these five Platonic solids. And I think this is really that was considered a core of maths back in those days. And I think maybe we've lost sight of that sort of stuff.
So your book's sort of attacking this from slightly odd angles. Now the book is called How to Build a Brain.
Yep.
I am wondering how you build a brain using maths. I mean, yep. You need a brain to do maths, but
well, do you need a brain to do maths? That may be something we'll discuss later. The brain building stuff is about really how very, very complex systems, of which there is no better example than a human brain, can arise from very simple starting points. So, I mean, if you look at a brain, it's built from billions of neurons, okay? So that sort of divides the problem into two parts. First, you want to understand how a neuron works, okay? And that's something which people are working on very hard. But then there's this whole other layer of the type of structures which appear when billions of neurons can interact with each other in these very complex ways. And this is really a great topic for mathematicians to study, because even from simple starting points, such as neurons firing, you know, we get the bewildering variety of thoughts that a human being is capable of having.
So this is the idea of emergence of consciousness and thoughts and other things, which you can't necessarily explain by the individual actions of neurons.
Right. So, I mean, there's a sort of toy model of all this sort of stuff, which was discovered or invented in the 1970s by one of the great living mathematicians, who's a guy called John Conway. And it's a thing called the game of life. And all it is, really, is it's a square grid where every cell on the grid is considered either living or dead. Okay, and there are very, very simple rules as to how cells come to life or die, depending on what their immediate neighbours are doing, okay? And the rules are very, very simple. You can write them down in two lines. But what's astonishing is that this simple game, which really plays itself because you don't have to input it, you decide on the starting configuration and then the game just runs according to its rules. It's been proven that this this game is actually has what is known as universal Turing complexity, which means that it is as complicated as any computer. It can compute anything which any computer can do.
No?
Very interesting. I was also looking at something else in your book that I wanted to know about, because I think this is interesting thing, is taking complex situations and abstracting them so that you can analyze them much more easily. And I wanted you to talk a bit about the dinner party and how you set it up.
The dinner party problem. Okay, so the question is, okay, if you invite some people around to your house for a dinner party, how many people do you need to invite to guarantee that there will be three people who either are mutual friends or mutual strangers? Okay, so that's the question. Now, there are some simplifying assumptions built in there. So we assume people are either friends or strangers. They don't sort of know each other a bit. And also, if I know you, then you must know me. Okay, so these sort of assumptions. But once you've made those, we have this question, okay? And if you reduce it to two people, right, then the answer is simple. Because if you invite just two people, then they either know each other or they don't. But if you invite three people, then it might be that I know you and you know Alok, but Alok doesn't know me. So we're not either mutual friends or mutual strangers. And if you play around with it, you can find configurations of four people where also there are no three mutual friends or mutual strangers, and five people. But once you get to six, then they're guaranteed to be either three mutual friends or mutual strangers. So that was an interesting question. But then, of course, one can one can build it up and ask more and say, well, okay, what about four mutual friends or mutual strangers? And once you start asking high numbers, these questions become hugely complex. So the answer for four is, in fact, 18. But once we get to five, we don't actually know the answer yet. It's, I think, somewhere between 43 and 49, but we don't know exactly. So, and the reason is that there are billions and billions of possible configurations. So, I mean, even from these very simple type of questions, even mathematicians can get stumped.
Ian, let's move on to your ideas then. And this idea that mathematics can be just a thing that mathematicians do to sort of stretch their brains, but then eventually some bit of science will end up using some theorem that's come up. It's happened lots of times.
If you look at the history of mathematics and pay attention to how it interacts with the surrounding culture and science, what you see is two driving forces for creating new mathematics. One is internal questions that mathematicians think of because they just sort of run into them and decide, I'd like to know what the answer to that is. But the other is problems that are derived from the outside world, problems that come from some important question in an area that's not mathematics. So, I mean, early geometry, you have the mathematics of areas and triangles and things like that. But that came from questions about measuring how much land a farmer's got and how much tax he ought to pay on it. So practical questions can feed into the maths. On the other hand, new mathematical discoveries made purely for their own beauty and interest can later turn out to have quite surprising applications which nobody who was creating the mathematics could possibly have dreamed would exist.
So Ian, give us an example of something where maths has enlightened our understanding of biology.
Evolution in lizards is a very interesting example of some quite serious maths in biological system. You tend to think of evolution in terms of survival of the fittest, whatever is best wins. Well, it turns out it's not quite that simple. There are some rather small lizards down the west coast of America, and they come in kind of three types. Within the species, there are three different morphs, as they call them, three distinguishable types. This is in the male, and they have orange throats, blue throats, or yellow throats. And each type of male uses a different mating strategy to attract the ladies. And it turns out that when you analyse this, orange is better than blue. Blue is better than yellow. but yellow is better than orange. That is, if orange and blue males are chasing the same female, the orange one will win. If blue and yellow ones are chasing the same female, blue ones will win. But if yellow and orange ones are chasing her, yellow will win.
I've just had a flash of insight here. This is a classic game.
This is a classic game that children play scissors, paper, stone.
That's right.
Okay, and the mathematical analysis of this is indeed in terms of what's called game theory. And game theory is exactly about that kind of game. You've got several players. They have a limited number of strategy choices. And the payoff to a given player, what they win or lose, depends on their strategy and their opponent's strategy. So these lizards are literally playing scissors, paper, stone. Now, what the mathematics says is that the strategy that works best, in fact, when you're playing scissors, paper, stone, is to play completely at random. If there's anything
so
systematic,
no strategy at all.
If I choose scissors too often, then you choose stone and win. Every so often, you have a margin. So anything systematic, in fact, in that particular game, then you will lose. You'll lose more than you will win. So the best you can do is break even, and the way to do it is to play at random. Now, in the lizards, it's not quite random because there is an extra layer on this, which is that it takes a little while for strategies to evolve and to change. And this introduces a kind of change over time, which is a little bit more systematic. So if you actually go to these communities and look, what you'll find is that for several years, most of the males will be the orange ones. And then it will shift quite suddenly, and then for few more years it'll be mostly the blue ones, and then it'll be mostly the yellow ones you see around, and then it goes round and round this triangle. So over a period of say 20 or 30 years, the lizards are trying each strategy roughly one third of the time, but they aren't doing it at random because they don't actually have they can't respond quickly enough to make it random. So they're trapped in this cycle.
Yeah.
There are very good biological reasons why the cycle works and why the different strategies beat each other. In scissors, paper, stone, it's really three different games. Scissors against paper, scissors have an advantage, but scissors against stone, they don't. And these lizards are playing three different games. So the maths and the biology and the very interesting lifestyle of these lizards all come together in a very nice story.
You talked a bit about how biology might inspire or spark further problems for mathematicians. Can you give us an example of a recent sort of area of biological research that's really sparked a revolution in math?
There's several. There's one that goes back to the 1950s, but a lot of the recent work is genuinely recent, which was why do tigers have stripes? Why do leopards have spots? Why do animals have the markings that they do? How are those markings produced? And in about 1956, I think it was, Alan Turing, who is the father of the computer, among other things, wrote down mathematical equations for a model of how he thought that the pattern of the markings was laid down in the embryo before it actually turns into fur and coloured proteins and pigments and things like that. There is some sort of pre-pattern laid down. And it's turned out that biologically it's a bit more complicated than that. But the mathematics of these equations, which are called reaction-diffusion equations, has turned out to be very, very interesting. It's fundamental to all kinds of pattern formation in physics and chemistry as well as in biology. And the mathematicians have been having a field day with this stuff. But if Turing hadn't started from the biological question, then nobody would have had any reason to work on that particular kind of equation. They weren't really coming out of problems in physics. They were beginning to turn up in a few chemistry problems, but the biology clearly stimulated that development.
Richard, Ian's book is talking about using maths to understand complexity, and you're kind of going the other way around, to building up complexity from basic mathematics. It sounds like quite an exciting time for mathematics. I mean, mathematics, which people might think is a sort of old, dusty subject that doesn't go anywhere, it sounds like it's a very different thing to what people imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the current period is an era when the nature of maths is really changing. And of course, now that mathematicians have powerful computers to play with, this really this is really giving them something to work with. And to some extent, I mean, there are an extent to which mathematicians are having to play catch up with the technology they have available. So there's a famous example of this called the Kepler conjecture, which dates from about 400 years ago. And it was a very, very simple question about how one can pile up spheres. So I think originally it was Sir Walter Raleigh was interested in how he could pile up cannonballs on his ships. But one can also look at oranges being piled up in a fruit stand, for example. And the question is, what's the most efficient way of piling up spheres?
I think I might know the answer. But go on.
Well, the thing is, everyone did know the answer. And the answer itself is no surprise at all. Greengrocers around the world know the answer. But actually proving that the answer is what everyone thinks it is turned out to be an absolutely mammoth task. And in 1998, a mathematician called Thomas Hales released a proof. He said, right, I've done it. But it was 250 pages long and plus 3 gigabytes of very difficult computation. And so he sent this into a mathematical journal, and they sent it out to a team of experts, saying, go on, check whether this is right or not. And the experts thought about it for 4 years and worked very intensively on trying to understand it. And at the end, they just had to give up and said, well, we're 99% sure this is right, but we can't fully certify it.
Never be a referee for a mathematical paper.
I can't imagine. Well, I'm sure that they did other things during that for those 4 years. But let's get you to sort of try and tackle a specific question that we're going to spring on you from last week's podcast.
Hi, I'm Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. And one question that I would love to have the answer to is a classification of all Calabi-Yau manifolds that are manifolds of vanishing first Chern class that are complex Kähler manifolds, a classification of all Calabi-Yau manifolds of every dimension. That would be a very useful question to have an answer to.
Okay, guys, I don't understand that question beyond the idea that Calabi-Yau manifolds I now have something to do with string theory. And who wants to tackle that? Ian, why don't you tell us what the question means before we answer it?
It's a rather abstract question in algebraic topology. So it's in a pretty difficult branch of mathematics, and it's not one you run across much in the street. What it's about is the shapes of high-dimensional surfaces, the equivalent of a surface. You know, in an ordinary surface, 2 dimensions, you've got the surface of a sphere, you've got a donut with a hole in it, you've got pretzels with 2 holes in them, and so on. And mathematicians quite a long time ago managed to classify all the different surfaces. But when you start going into higher dimensional spaces, which is a mathematician's way of saying more variables to play with, the range of shapes gets enormously complex, and there's a huge range of them. But in string theory, which is where people hope to unify quantum mechanics and relativity, there are some sort of there is a class of shapes which naturally come up. So they're rather special, but there's still an awful lot of them. And these are the things called Calabi-Yau manifolds. So Calabi and Yau were two mathematicians, and a manifold is a multidimensional surface. So what Brian is asking for is essentially to have a list of all of the different shapes that could be basic to string theory. And if you're doing string theory, it would be sort of nice to know what exactly you're working with. This is a deep and difficult problem, but I think there is some hope that it might be answered. I was reading recently of work. The way mathematicians always do this kind of thing, and it seems to work, is to say, well, you kind of break these, you're trying to study some particular type of shape. Break it up into the basic small shapes out of which it is made. Study them, study how they fit together. And if you're really clever, you can then reconstitute all the things that might happen. So with surfaces, they discovered that the simplest bits and pieces were basically you start with a sphere and you add handles, you know, just like a handle on a suitcase. If you keep adding handles to a sphere, you get a sphere with you get a thing like a donut, but with lots of holes. Now, if you understand the handles and you understand how to add them and combine them together, you can actually show that the only possibilities are these many-hole donuts. So what the mathematicians and physicists would love to do is the same game with these very fancy Calabi-Yau manifolds. And The good news is that they're beginning to see how to do it. It's going to involve a lot of computation. It's going to be computer-based. But there may be a prospect of answering this.
Okay, well, these two next questions are actually from readers via Facebook. Andrew Reitmeier on Facebook said, in a world of increasing complexity and many media outlets warning me of ever more obscure dangers, what branch of statistics should I learn to enable me to best assess my best action to any given risk or combination of risks, preferably one that does not use the term statistically significant?
The crucial technique is this idea of conditional probability, I would say. If you roll a dice, it can tell you that the probability of getting a 5 is a 1/6, okay? But what's interesting is when you have more data to work with as a starting point. So if you know the dice is biased or not perfectly fair, then you have to build that into the starting assumptions. And so there's this idea of Bayesian probability, which is where one updates the probability one assigns an event depending on the information one has available. So you have a starting probability, which is called your Bayesian prior, and then you build in some more background information. And then you can update the probability you have to see whether the event is now seems more or less likely.
So Bayesian statistics is the thing you should learn. There's another question from Davith Stevenson, also on Facebook. In the 20th century, we saw massive advances in mathematics. Whole new branches and areas of study seemingly came out of nowhere. And computing technology, which was previously non-existent, has allowed us to make huge leaps in cryptography, solve age-old theorems via modern methods, and continue the search for primes in our own homes. Even retrospectively, it seems difficult to have seen these things coming. So the obvious next question is, what can we expect in the next 100 years? Is it possible to tell at this early stage? You've got a minute to just sort of predict what's happening.
Okay, don't take this too seriously. The big trends of the past will continue, and they are mathematics interacting with more and more different areas of human activity, and this rapid growth in our ability to calculate things. So what I would forecast is that you'll start to see mathematics showing up fairly seriously in areas where in the past you might not have expected. In politics, let's say, political math. We've got financial mathematics now. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. It created the derivatives industry and it nearly brought down the entire world financial system. So I think maths will spread into some of the areas traditionally associated with the humanities rather than science as such. It will certainly, there is this enormous and very strong development towards biology, and there will be feedback the other way. A lot of this is going to have to involve a much closer interaction between mathematicians and computers than was the case even 20 years ago. A huge amount of maths now, even pure maths, even stuff where people basically say that it's really pencil and paper sort of maths, you often find there's a computer in there somewhere just to do the experiments, play around, see what's going. So I think these trends will combine and reinforce each other. And the other thing mathematicians do is they reinvent the past. They go back to the great discoveries of 50 or 100 years ago and say, you know, there's another way of doing that. And then they discover that this new insight can be used on much more complicated questions of the same kind. Finally, talking of complication, complexity, complex systems, complexity science, it's not just a question of saying, oh my God, this is incredibly complicated, and throwing up your hands. What the mathematics is beginning to show is there are kind of rules to complexity. Richard mentioned Conway's Game of Life. Very simple rules giving rise to very complex behaviour. And it's a bit of a drowning man clutching at straws, but the simplicity behind the complexity is what you'd really like to get your hands on. And there is a growing understanding of how complex behaviour emerges from simple rules. And I think there'll be a lot more mathematics and a lot of science that comes out of that.
So maths moving into every bit of life. It's a good time to be a mathematician and to study maths at school, I would say. Well, Richard's book, How to Build a Brain, is out this week, the 31st of March. So there's just enough time to read that before you then go down to the shops to buy Ian's book, The Mathematics of Life, which is out on the 7th of April. Follow this podcast on Twitter. Science Weekly is the name you need to look for. And we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, just look for Guardian Science. We'll all be back in the studio in just a few minutes. But first, let's transport ourselves downstairs to the science desk.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Last week, Brian Cox visited The Guardian.
Hi.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, all right?
How are you?
Yeah, good, good.
Good night, is it?
Do you fancy going out for lunch, please?
I think so.
I'd love to, yeah.
Can I get you coffee?
Yeah, I'd love to.
He's now so high profile, impressionists are making him part of their act.
The great gas giants of Jupiter and Saturn. And if they were the size of a football that smelled of PVC, you get from Woolworths.
He's even being spoofed on YouTube, the modern-day equivalent of getting your own spitting image puppet.
The world is really humongous, and it's full of fascinating things like water and ice.
Excuse me, I'm really sorry to break this up. We need you to get on here. I'm really sorry.
Sorry.
Sorry to crack.
But that's just that just shows you how strange the world is, isn't it?
So this is the list of
He was here to answer Guardian readers' questions. I think there were already about 300 by the time he actually sat down next to me at the Guardian Science desk. He only had an hour to get through them all. He stood no chance.
So I thought the third one was quite a nice one. Maybe we should put a little message like, hello, everyone.
We had been planning to talk to him as he responded to those questions in front of the computer. But because the whole office was fawning over him and tweeting pictures, we had to whisk him away to one of our studios for everyone's safety. That's better.
I'm Brian Cox, and I don't know which title to give you. Professor of Particle Physics at the University of Manchester, BBC science presenter, and anything else you'd like, ex-pop star.
And friend of Timmy Mallett's.
Friend of Timmy Mallett, yeah. It's a little known fact.
Before we go on to the science questions, one thing that was really intriguing, you've just been in talking to the Guardian readership about various bits of physics on the blogs, and just before you started, you were telling us about an interaction you had with the supermodel last night. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I was just out, and I don't know actually. I don't think I want to actually, because it'd be a name drop, and it probably breaks confidence. So I'm not going to do that. But it was an interaction, intellectual interaction. A well-known supermodel came up, started talking about entropy, said that she'd loved the series and recited back to me what she'd understood about entropy and second law thermodynamics and got it absolutely correct. So there you go.
Is that the weirdest sort of interaction you've had as a result of the program?
Yes, it's the most unexpected. You know, but that's the thing, actually. The thing is that I think the surprising thing for me has been the breadth of audience. You know, it's certainly gone all the way from kids of 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, all the way up to, you know, 80-year-olds. And you know, broadly, that the response has been good from all of them, which has been nice.
The last time you were on this podcast, it was about a year ago. Wonders of the Solar System was about to come out. There have been some clips going around. Now, a year later, 10 programmes later, Wonders of the Universe is just about to finish. Has it been a bit of a roller coaster?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything prepares you for really large success, particularly certainly in the language of documentary. You know, it's been a tremendous success. The viewing figures are immense, and that does put you into a different bracket. You know, you stop even being a science presenter, let alone an academic. You become viewed as a celebrity. Right, and in fact, I saw there's some really amusing comments occasionally on the web. Some people say, you know, why are BBC using celebrities to present science programmes? You know, it's kind of because you get thought.
Do you not see yourself as a celebrity?
Not at all. I mean, and that I saw a great article by Stephen Fry in the Times recently where he pointed out that the scale of it sometimes take you by surprise when you've got a programme on that's 6 million people are watching. That's a lot of people, and so if you go shopping, then you can't move because literally, you know, 1 in 5 people has seen the programme in the shop or something like that. And they just want to come and say hello, or they want their picture taken. It's always very nice and positive, but it just prevents you just doing normal things. And I've really found that this time, more than Solar System, actually, because I think this one had bigger viewing figures and I'd already become relatively well-known from Solar System. So it does put you in a a strange position that you're not really prepared for. It's not negative, but it's just different. It's just, you know. And the other thing that's interesting is that people listen to everything you say. So you can tweet something and the next day it's in a newspaper. And I've argued for ages, I've thought and believed for ages that science should be part of popular culture. It is so important that it has to be up there with football and X Factor. And it should be, because, I mean, it should be in many ways above those in everybody's consciousness, because it is so genuinely important. And so when it happens to you in a small way and you become part of popular culture, then you can't whinge about it.
Do you miss the physics, though?
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm going back now essentially to do something I've never really wanted to do, and I'm really excited about now, which is work on a new lecture course for undergraduate physics at Manchester in relativity and probably quantum mechanics, and that now excites me. That in the past I've been so focused on research that I didn't really want to teach. I like having PhD students, but I wasn't that bothered about teaching undergraduates actually. But interestingly, after this, I want to go back to something very basic and pure in a way. You know, I want to go back, and so I'm actually really excited about putting that together.
And so when would that course be taught?
I don't know, we've been looking at doing it. I mean, there's quite a delay, but we've been looking at doing it maybe in 2 years, so we're putting it together
now. If there are kids out there doing A-levels in physics and they go to the University of Manchester in a couple of years to do physics at university, they're going to get a lecture course possibly by you.
The plan is for myself and Jeff Forshaw, who I wrote the book Equals MC Squared with, writing one about quantum mechanics now, so for us to sort of share that lecture course and base it actually around the popular books to some extent, certainly the approach that we put together in the popular books.
Back to the TV, when is the next series? When are you starting?
So we start filming it in September. And it's going to, we'll probably end up filming for almost a year. And that's not because it's not going to be solid. I think one of the things that we actually learned from Wonders of the Universe was that there probably wasn't enough space between filming blocks. I mean, it was quite a compressed series to film, actually. So I think we're going to start filming in September, probably run through to the end of maybe June, actually.
And this one's about life.
Yeah.
So what can physicists say about life?
Well, it is, as you say, it's going to be a physicist take on life. So it's going to be, it's much more, because it's not my direct field, it's going to be much more, I think, a learning experience for me. But it's questions that a physicist would ask, like, for example, what are the different ways you can provide an energy source for life? So there's obviously things like photosynthesis and respiration, but what's the minimal set of things you need? You need an electron donor, you need an electron receptor, right? So you can have, obviously, oxygen and carbohydrate, but you could have, I know there are life forms that essentially use hydrogen ions in water as the electron donors, right? So it's kind of digging deep into the biochemistry, the physiology of life, which is, you know, for me is physics, right? I mean, I'll get some argument about that from my academic colleagues, but it's, you know, these are other questions that a physicist would ask, which I actually, we've got a fascinating panel that has been put together by Dame Nancy Rothwell, who runs the University of Manchester, is the president of the university and a good friend of mine. And she put together a panel of about 20 professors in life sciences. We've got the biggest life sciences department in the country, who just sit there in a room and we brainstorm. And I ask them questions and they come up with questions. So hopefully it's not like I'm writing a series about life. It's essentially we have 20 experts saying, well, what would we do? The BBC have now got this opportunity to make a programme about the fundamental basis of life. What shall we do? It's a completely blank slate. It's very exciting. One of the questions was that I asked was, well, obviously there's a limit to how well eyes work, the resolving power of eyes, right? It's obviously related to the wavelength of visible light. Are there animals that have bumped up against that physical limit, that physical restriction? Turns out that there probably are. Birds of prey are probably at the limit of the resolving power that you can manage given any reasonably sized eye in a head and the wavelength of visible light. So it's well, actually not even the size of the eye. I mean, it already sees interest in physics here, because it doesn't matter what the size of the eye. I mean, the basic physical restriction is the wavelength of light. And they seem to be bumping up against that. So it's questions like that. Another one I asked was which caused much amusement and then loads of discussion, was I asked, is there a Drake equation for life? So, you know, the Drake equation is a way of focusing your attention on the question, are there civilizations out there? So you can break it down to how many planets are there around distant stars? Are there any habitable zone? Do you need liquid water on the surface and all those things? So my question was, what's the Drake equation for life? What are the minimal set of things you need? Probably need water, for example, as a solvent. Or do you? Could you have methane as a solvent like you have on Titan? You know, so break it down. And they kind of laughed and went, yeah, bloody reductionist physicist, you know. And then got into about a two-hour-long discussion about what are the minimal set of requirements for life. So it'd be things like that. I mean, obviously, we're developing the series.
Do you think getting physicists to ask questions like that actually might produce interesting collaborations or other questions that these guys might go away and actually do papers on?
Well, you know, it's...
And it sounds a bit hubristic, I know, but perhaps.
Well, I mean, it is true to say in universities that we're trying to break down the barriers between departments for that reason, because physicists think differently to biologists. And, you know, and there is, that's one of the great things about university. It should be this open think tank where economists and biologists and physicists and arts, you know, people and everyone merges together, and you will get new research out of that. We know that. And it's actually a real struggle to break down the barriers. So, you know, you never know, actually, just by putting different academics from different fields in one room, we all know already that that's a valuable thing to do.
So questions about dumbing down, that just doesn't apply there, does it? You're actually creating knowledge in that sense, possibly.
It's not, I mean, you know, that's one of the amusing, it's one of the difficult things, I think, about putting science on television, that it's essentially clearly you could stand there and do a lecture. In fact, that's one of the things, one of the projects I've got kind of on the back burner. I want to do it in with the BBC. We've been talking about it vaguely, about actually just doing some lectures, like the Christmas lectures, but for adults, just actually standing there and doing a lecture, you know. But I mean, in a documentary, a prime time documentary for BBC Two, there's obviously a payoff between giving a lecture and delivering something that people just want to watch, because it's really entertaining. It's Sunday night, you know, you've got to entertain as well as educate.
So you've done the solar system, you've done the universe, you're about to do life. You're essentially doing a 21st century version of that excellent Carl Sagan series, Cosmos. I mean, you're probably thinking this already all the way. I mean, he must be a hero of yours. I mean, you said he is. Him, Feynman, the great communicators. I mean, do you think that there is a space there to sort of bring science, all science? I mean, Sagan did everything to massive, massive audiences all over again.
Yes, I mean and it's vital that particularly the BBC, I think, as a public service broadcaster, tries to do that and has the ambition to do that. It's part of the wider aim that we all share. I know you share it as well, although you're probably neutral in this podcast. But to make Britain a more scientific country, you know. I mean, I've got a new slogan. I keep wandering around saying to every MP that I meet, I go, "Make Britain the best place in the world to do science and engineering." Stand up, David Cameron. Stand up and make that speech. I will make Britain the best place in the world to do science and engineering, in the way that Kennedy said we choose to go to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. I actually think that that's achievable. We've got the foundation, we've got the basis, we've got, you know, arguably the best universities in the world, one of the best innovation systems in the world, some of the best high-tech companies in the world. It's all here. A little push, I think. And you're talking bits of money, bits of, you know, refocusing, but you're talking about single-figure billions to make a dream like that happen. You're not talking about tens of billions. So it's actually, in my view, it's achievable. What it needs is public support, because it's a democracy. And part of that is to have popular science programmes on television.
You can read some of Brian's responses to the Q&A. The link's on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. While you're there, make sure you subscribe to this podcast so that every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. You'll also find 5 years of our programme archives on the website too, all free, including last year's chat with Brian, complete with the F-bomb, just 55 seconds in.
Our guy who went down on his rope to look at it said, "I was misinformed. Nobody told me it was active." That's why we were there to film it. So yeah, we had some adventures.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
It's show and tell time now. Nell, Ian and Richard have brought in some of their favourite stories from the week. So let's start with you, Richard. This is a story you found about a software programme that you think might replace scientists.
Yes, it's a programme called Eureka, which was developed by Michael Schmidt and Hod Libson in the Cornell University in New York. What they did was they got a thing called a double pendulum, which is So if you imagine a normal pendulum is a straight rod with a weight on the end, okay? And this is a very simple, predictable thing. If you just see it swinging, you know, it goes like clockwork almost literally, right? But if you then, if you replace the weight with a hinge and then put another rod with a weight on the end of that, you've got a double pendulum. And what's interesting about it is that it is it's literally a chaotic system. So this is extremely unpredictable. And they developed some software to analyze the motion of this pendulum, this double pendulum. And of course, whilst I say that the motion is unpredictable, we know some of the limits with what it's going to do. It's not going to sort of jump up and run around the room. There are rules which it must obey, even amongst the chaotic motion. And one of the key rules is called the conservation of energy. So a pendulum's got two types of energy. It's got potential energy, depending on how high it is, and it's got kinetic energy, depending on how fast it's moving. And the total energy is conserved, right? This is one of the sort of basic laws of Newtonian physics. And what's very exciting is that this computer program, Eureka, was actually able to discover the law of conservation of energy just from analysing the motion of the pendulum.
There's something wonderful yet concerning about this, isn't there? Because it's about this is the beginning of many other computer programs that also exist that essentially just rediscover theories. That's fine. And then the idea is that they're going to discover new theories, new scientific ideas. I mean, how feasible is that?
Well, I mean, if you take this this story at face value, it seems to be well and truly happening. Now that they've discovered this program, lots of different scientists seem to be wanting to use it, including a biologist who's interested in a particular type of bacteria which occurs in the soil. And this bacteria can... It transforms from being a sort of soft bacteria to being a hard-shelled spore. And the question is, what causes this transformation? And this biologist looked at it and come up with various theories. But he fed the data into this Eureka program, which came up with an answer of sorts. It came up with a sort of formula which says what are the factors which promote this transformation. Unfortunately, looking at the answer, no one's been able to quite make sense of it. They can't say what is this crucial information which determines whether the bacteria is going to transform or not. So, I mean, it seems that the computer's one step ahead of us there.
Let's move on now. Now, the story you've brought in is completely different. it's more about history than physical maths and things, isn't it?
Well, no. I just have a photo, really, and a sort of interesting hypothesis from Pakistan after the floods last year. It seems that all the spiders have migrated up into the trees, and so you get these incredible sort of pictures of trees swathed in spider webs, which are killing the trees, but also seem to have reduced the number of malarial mosquitoes in the region. So it's not so much a story, but more an observation. I was actually interested in Ian's story about the cuckoo eggs and the arms race.
It's actually similar, because the one you've just described with the spiders is... a mathematical biologist would say that this is sort of ecological dynamics. This is how different species interact in the environment. So you've got spiders and you've clearly got the malaria parasite. And what else is going on there? You'd need to sort out the important players in the dynamics. And that could be a task for Eureka, indeed. So all of this stuff's coming together. Yeah, my story is about cuckoo's eggs. And it's two zoologists in Cambridge, Mary Caswell Stoddard and Martin Stevens, who have been looking at how good the cuckoo is at disguising its egg to look like those in the nest that it's laying in, and how vigorous the species it's laying in is at trying to kick out cuckoo's eggs. So, for example, the redstart, which lays a blue egg, is very good at detecting and kicking out cuckoo's eggs, whereas some other species hardly notice, even if the cuckoo's egg is a pretty poor fake, and they don't kick it out very aggressively.
So what's the hypothesis for what's going on there?
Okay, well, the let's start with the puzzle. The puzzle is it doesn't sound the way it ought to. The closer, the better the cuckoo is at mimicking a particular bird's egg, the more vigorously that species of bird detects and kicks out cuckoo's eggs. So the best fakes are being thrown out, and the poor ones are not. But you have to understand it's a different species of bird. Some species that are very good at detecting them seem to be the ones where the cuckoo is going to enormous lengths to lay a very good fake. And so the suggested explanation is this is an evolutionary arms race, which is basically that the two players concerned drive each other to ever greater extremes. So let's say the Red Star was actually quite good at detecting cuckoo's eggs in the first place. So that forces the cuckoo, at least the sort of those cuckoos who decide to lay in Red Star nests, they have to do a better job. But then the Red Star is then forced to improve its cuckoo's egg detecting system. And these things drive each other round and round to greater and greater extremes. And this is one of the two main sorts of dynamics you would get in these brood parasite host dynamical systems. One is that everything settles down to some sort of nice compromise where basically a certain number of cuckoo's eggs get hatched and nobody worries too much about it because everything works okay, or you get this runaway arms race.
After that trip through biology, physics, computer science, ecology and natural history, we'll probably leave the news there just for now, I think. Links to all this stuff can be found on our blog and also on our Facebook group. Just search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks to our mathematicians, Ian Stewart and Richard L. Wess. Richard's book is called How to Build a Brain. Ian's is called The Mathematics of Life. Oh, and thanks to Brian Cox as well, whose BBC Two series Wonders of the Universe is on telly right now. Or if you've missed it, you can go to iPlayer. Next week, we discuss the concept of self with philosophy writer Julian Baggini. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Brian Cox, and you're listening to The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox, and you're listening to The Science Weekly podcast.
Hi, I'm also Brian Cox, and you're listening to The Guardian's Weekly Science podcast.
Hi, and I'm the fourth Brian Cox, and you're listening to The Guardian Weekly podcast.
So I've actually stopped swearing.
Forget the swearing.
Well, I haven't stopped swearing, but I've stopped swearing. The only one I can say is knobber, apparently, because that seems to knobbing amazing.
Is that word?
It's my playground word from the 70s. And it seems to have slipped through the net, that one.
It was a very showbiz day here at The Guardian, because we also had Ariana Huffington from the internet in the building. From the internet. That's amazing. Isn't the universe brilliant?
You're so... For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.